And the two branches of theoretical physics I want to talk about today are, on the one hand, entanglement in quantum information theory, and on the other hand, black holes in string theory, which at first sight seem unrelated, perhaps. And there's some non-technical reviews, less technical I should say, to be found here. And my collaborator, Laurent, is sitting at the back there. He'll help out from time to time, no doubt. String theory has undergone a variety of different evolutions. It was originally designed to explain phenomena in nuclear physics, pions, nucleons, strong interactions. In the 1980s, it was realized it could also describe gravity, and it became a candidate for a unified theory. And it still is. But in recent years, we've seen it branch out into other areas of physics, particularly with the ABS-CFT correspondence. And there are now applications to superconductors, fluid mechanics, cosmic strings are sometimes invoked. And today I want to talk about yet another application of string theory techniques, which is unrelated at first sight to the unification milieu, which is black hole qubit correspondence. Now, I don't need to remind this audience that two qubits, Alice and Bob, can be described by a state like this. The measure of the entanglement, and with two qubits, the situation is simple. Either they're entangled or they're not. And the criterion is a non-vanishing two-tangle, which looks like this. And the two-tangle has a symmetry. We can act on the Alice index A with an SL2A, and the Bob index B with an SL2B. And this coefficient AB transforms as a 2 comma 2 under SL2 Alice cross SL2 Bob. And there's also a discrete duality that interchanges Alice and Bob. For normalized states, and sometimes I'll find it convenient not to normalize, tau lies between 0 and 1, so that a maximally entangled state, such as a Bell state, has tau equals 1, a separable state has tau equals 0. Now things get more interesting when we come to three qubits, Alice, Bob, and Charlie, and then there's more than one way of getting them entangled. Now we have eight coefficients, A0, 0, 0 through A111. So we can represent this arrangement by a Q instead of a square for two qubits or a line for one qubit. And this cubic array, this 2 by 2 by 2 array, is what the mathematician Arthur Cayley called a hypermatrix back in 1845. Now, there are more than one way, as you know, of entangling three qubits. There's the trivial class, there's the separable ABC class, such as this one. We can have biseparable states where Bob and Charlie are entangled but not Alice. Then there's two ways of having three-way entanglement, the W state, such as this, and the GHZ state, such as this. And what distinguishes the GHZ state from the W state is a non-vanishing three-tangle. And interestingly enough, the three-tangle is given by a quantity that Cayley called the hyperdeterminant. So that's capital D for hyperdeterminant. And it generalizes the notion of the determinant of a 2 by 2 matrix to a 2 by 2 by 2 cubic array. And it's a quartic polynomial in the A's. And if I use the letter A for Alice, B for Bob, C for Charlie, we've got four of them. And to make an invariant, we use the two-dimensional alternating symbol epsilon to soak up the indices, and we need 6 of those. And this object is the 3-tangle, and it's invariant under 3 SR2s, Alice, Bob, Charlie. And it transforms as a 2 comma 2 comma 2. And there's also a discrete triality where you interchange Alice, Bob, and Charlie. If you want to write it out in full, that's how it looks. Now for something completely different, black holes. We're going to be interested in charged black holes. And the simplest example of that, and we're going to be in 4 dimensions, is the Riesel-Nordström metric. It describes the gravitational field outside a body with mass m and electric charge q in appropriate units. Here's the Coulomb potential from the Maxwell field. There are 2 horizons located at r plus and r minus. And 2 interesting quantities are, on the one hand, the surface gravity, which is the acceleration due to gravity at the horizon, and the area of the horizon, which looks like this. Now, in the 70s, Stephen Hawking told us that black holes are not as black as they're painted. They can radiate energy with a temperature T, which is given by the surface gravity, and with the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy S, which is 1/4 the area of the event horizon. In the extremal case where, in appropriate units, mass equals the charge, the entropy depends only on Q and the temperature vanishes. Now, we're going to include magnetic charges as well as electric ones. And if we do that, roughly speaking, everywhere you saw a q squared, you replace it by q squared plus p squared. We believe, or it's conjectured, that the only black holes that actually exist are those with m greater than or equal to q, because otherwise you'd have a naked singularity. And we're going to be focusing on the extremal case where the 2 horizons coalesce. And the extremal case is interesting because the mutual electrostatic repulsion exactly cancels the gravitational attraction. So we can have many of these multi-centered solutions, and it's still stable. Now, we're going to be interested in string theory, or in practice, it's low energy limit supergravity, which incorporates Bose-Fermi symmetry. So the graviton has a supersymmetric partner, the gravitino, and one can have in 4 dimensions up to 8 gravitinos. We're going to be looking at 2 particular theories. One has 2 supersymmetries, and we call it the STU model. And it has not 1 photon, but 4 photons. So this is not a phenomenologically realistic model. It's a mathematically interesting model with 4 photons. And the N equal 8 theory has 28 photons. So if we include magnetic charge, we're going to be looking at black holes with 8 charges in the case of the N equal 2 STU and 56 charges in the case of the maximal N equal 8. Now, you start with the Lagrangian with Hatch supersymmetry, and the solution may or may not preserve that supersymmetry. And the criterion, just like those onyx symmetries you look for killing vectors. So supersymmetries are described by killing spinners, covariantly constant spinners. And if the black hole preserves some supersymmetry, it's said to be BPS after these gentlemen. And it turns out that all BPS black holes are extremal, but the converse need not be true. You can have extremal black holes that are not BPS. So what is this STU model? It's basically general relativity coupled to some matter fields. and we focus on the bosons, in addition to the four photons, there are three complex scalars that we call S, T, and U, hence the name. And the interesting thing about it in the present context is that its equations in motion have a symmetry, a global symmetry, which is SL2S plus SL2T plus SL2U, and a discrete triality that interchanges S, T, and U. So already you may see some link coming up. The most general black hole, I won't bother to write down its metric, will have eight charges. And we call the electric ones Q and the magnetic ones P. And if you work out 1/4 the area of the event horizon in the extremal case, as was done in 96, the entropy is some complicated function of the P's and the Q's. Now, where does the black hole correspondence come in? I can tell you a little story, because Peter Levoy is in the audience. I was listening to a talk of his in Tasmania, of all places, on 3-qubit entanglement. He was talking about Cayley's hyperdeterminant. And I noticed that the symmetry he was describing, SL2 Alice cross SL2 Bob cross SL2 Charlie, was the same that appeared in the work we'd been doing on black holes. So when I got back to the UK, I got out my old notes and asked what would happen if we identified the ST and U with Alice, Bob, Charlie, and the eight black hole charges with the eight coefficients that appear in the 3-qubit state. Now, the black hole charges are real, so we're going to be focusing, for the moment anyway, on real coefficients, and I'll relax that later in the talk. And I said, well, this Cayley's hyperdeterminant must be good for something. What's it good for? Well, it turns out that complicated function of the charges is just, in this language, Cayley's hyperdeterminant. So the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of this black hole and the entanglement measure for 3 qubits are both described by the same mathematical quantity, namely Cayley's hyperdeterminant. And as I say, this is a mathematical coincidence. We don't yet have any physical reason for why they should be related. But I will argue that whether or not there's a physical relation, it will be a useful one. And this turns out to be the tip of an iceberg. It turns out there are many phenomena in black hole physics that match in quantum information theory and vice versa. And we can learn new things on either side. If I look at a solution where there are just 4 of the 8 charges switched on, particularly these 3, it obeys the no force condition. You can put the 4 centers anywhere you like. And you can regard it as a bound state of 4 individual black holes with these individual charges. If you had a 5th one, that no longer works. But for the 4, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, it works. And so we have a map between black holes and 3-qubit states. This particular no-force charge black hole corresponds to what's usually called the GHZ or Mervyn state. And it preserves some supersymmetry, but if you flip the sign, the determinant, hyperdeterminant flips sign, and it goes from preserving supersymmetry to not preserving supersymmetry. Now, in the context of the n equals 2 theory, you can either preserve half or none. But if you embed the n equals 2 theory in the n equal 8 theory, I can regard it as the 56 charge black hole where I switch on just 8 of the charges. And in that case, you can have smaller fractions of supersymmetry. And this one corresponds to a 1/8 supersymmetry, BPS. This GHZ state has no supersymmetry on the black hole side. Now, one of the developments in the 90s in string theory was the realization that the five string theories were really part of a deeper, more profound theory called M theory, which is an 11-dimensional theory that involves brains as well as strings. And one can understand black holes in four dimensions as brains that wrap around the extra dimensions. So if you have a P brain wrapped around P, for example, suppose the extra dimensions were just circles, the brain could wrap around the circles P times P of the circles, and you get a naught brain in four dimensions. So a four-dimensional observer would interpret that as a four-dimensional black hole. And the charges of the black hole depend on how the brains wrap around the extra dimensions. So this four-charged black hole I've just been telling you about corresponds to four three brains, as it turns out. And if I call the space-time x0, x1, x2, x3, and the extra six dimensions of the string theory, then they wrap around these n times, and that's the charges of the black hole. So we asked ourselves, is there a qubit? And the virtue of this, I should say, is that you can get, unlike Hawking, you had a macroscopic thermodynamic argument for the entropy. Strongjaw and Raffi used this logic to get a microscopic calculation by counting the number of states and taking the logarithm, and their microscopic calculation exactly matched 1/4 the area of the event horizon, at least to lowest order. That was one of the triumphs of M theory. So we asked ourselves whether there's a qubit interpretation of the wrapped brains. And in particular, we wanted to know, in quantum information theory, we have these two values, 0, 1, left, right, up, down. Where is that two-valuedness on the black hole side? And this is our interpretation. The across means the brain wraps the circle, and naught means it doesn't. And we've got four brains in the lower corner wrapping the 5, 7, 9, and so on. So this gives us a four-charged black hole with these charges. And the qubit interpretation is, you think of the six circles as being the product of three two toruses. If the brain wraps the first of the circles, it's a naught. If it wraps the second one, it's a one. So these eight ways of wrapping give you the eight basis vectors, and the four particular wrappings give you a particular state with four cats corresponding to a four-charged black hole. So this provides an explanation, if you like, of the two-valuedness. X naught is a naught, naught X is a one, or as Shakespeare may have put it, to wrap or not to wrap, that is the qubit. And we now see why it's the three qubits were singled out. It's because there are six extra dimensions. For the benefit of the experts, this was a type 2b description. You can also do a type 2a description where instead of naught X and X naught, you have XX and naught on. Now, we also made contact with some other well-known results in quantum information theory. The most general real three-qubit state can be described by just five parameters, four numbers and an angle. And if we go back to this picture, here we have just four numbers. But if we were to tilt one of the brains so that they intersected at an angle, you get a fifth parameter. And you get a state, if you use the dictionary, you get a state which is precisely this one. So here's a picture summarizing what I've been saying so far. On the left-hand side, this is how you classify black holes in the STU model. If there's no black hole, you have full supersymmetry. And this is embedding it in the N equal 8 picture. One black hole is half supersymmetric. Two black holes, or a black, which is the same thing as a black hole with two charges when you superimpose them, is one quarter supersymmetric. And then the 1/8 supersymmetric falls into either 3 or 4, but only the N equal 4, only the black hole with four charges has a non-vanishing Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. Now we look on the qubit side, and this is how quantum information theorists classify the entanglement of three qubits. You've got the trivial null state, you've got the separable state, Alice, Bob, Charlie, you've got the bipartite entangled states, the W state and the GHZ state are both tripartite, but only the GHZ state has the non-vanishing hyperdeterminant. And you see there's just a one-to-one map here with the hyperdeterminant and the entropy given by the same expression. So, as I said, this is a black hole that solves this N equal 2 supergravity theory. Now, you can also look at more supersymmetry, N equal 4, which has more photons, has 12 photons, so there'll be 24 charges. And the maximal N equal 8 supergravity has 56 charges. But instead of three SL2s, as we had here, what you get is an SL2 plus an SO6 comma 6. And in the N equal 8 case, you get the exceptional group E7 in Cartan's classification of Lie groups. And you know, if you count the charges, you get 0, 8, 24, 56 for N equal 1, 2, 4, and 8. And those five parameters I was telling you about, not only do they work in the N equal 2 case, you can generate all these solutions using these groups, starting from a seed solution with just five parameters. So, does this maximal N equal 8 black hole have a similar quantum information interpretation, we asked Ferrara, and I asked ourselves. And at first sight, you might say no, because we've seen that the group that governs n qubits is SL2 to the n, and E7 is not SL2 to the n, but it contains as a subgroup 7 SL2s. So we said maybe it's got something to do with 7 qubits. But it can't be just any old collection of 7 qubits, because we have to have this E7 symmetry. And our interpretation is, if you decompose the E7 under 7 SL2s, which we'll call Alice, Bob, Dave, Emma, Fred, Charlie, George, something interesting happens. You get just doublets and singlets. Now, three twos, if you remember, was described three qubits. So we've got seven copies of three qubits. And there are eight numbers in each. So 7 times 8 is 56. And then you also get singlets. And the singlets, the doublets come in a pattern. 1, 2, 4, 2, 3, 5, and so on. So what we interpret this as is a 56-dimensional Hilbert space, which is a direct sum of 7 3-qubit Hilbert spaces. But they're related. See, Alice appears here, and here, and here. And what you do is go through the alphabet, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and just cyclically commute, and that gives you this state. So it's a 7 qubits, but they're undergoing at most tripartite entanglement. And you can represent that by a nice little picture, which the mathematicians already knew about, called the Fano plane. And the Fano plane has 7 vertices, which are the 7 qubits, and 7 lines. The circle counts as a line. And the line represents 3 qubit entanglement. So this line says Alice and Charlie are entangled with George. George and Fred are entangled with Bob. And there are 7 ways of doing it. Now, this Fano plane wasn't invented to describe qubits, of course, or even black holes. The reason the mathematicians are interested in it is because it's the multiplication table for the Octonians. As you probably know, there are 4 kinds of numbers that mathematicians like to deal with. Real numbers with no imaginary part, complex numbers with 1 imaginary part, quaternions with 3, and Octonians with 7. And that Fano plane gives you the multiplication table for the 7 imaginary Octonians. And there it is. Incidentally, I said we learn things about quantum information theory from string theory. We also learn things about string theory going the other way. And if we look at that Fano plane, you remember it had 7 lines, but you can truncate it, and that corresponded to the n equal 8 supergravity with E7 symmetry. If you truncate the diagram to 3 lines, that gives you the multiplication table for the quaternions, and that corresponds to a truncated n equal 4 supergravity. Similarly, 1 line gives you this one, which is our STU model with some extra scalars in it, and no lines gives you this one, which is SL2 to the 7th again. So somehow the supergravity knows about the 7 qubits too. And these, it turns out, have an extra significance to do with membranes, and they have some other interesting properties that I don't have time to tell you about. Now, we said the STU black hole has 8 charges, but a non-extremal STU black hole has some other numbers. It has a mass, which gives you 9 parameters. There's a magnetic analog of the mass called the Knott charge, which gives you 10. And then you have the asymptotic value of the 3 complex scalars, which is another 6. So from that point of view, you need 16 parameters rather than 8 to describe it. And as Peter pointed out, 16, well, he pointed out more than just this, but 16 is the number to describe 4 qubits. So this is interesting because although we reproduced everything about 3 qubits, it was already well known in the quantum information literature. 4 qubits is a much more complicated problem. And some results were known, and I'll describe them in just a minute. But we have what we believe is an original result using the black hole qubit correspondence. Again, I'll just skip just take my word for it, that if you look in the black hole string literature, you find that under this 16 parameter classification, there are 31 kinds of black hole. So we, Boston, Dahaniaka, Marani, Rubens, and myself, asked ourselves whether we could use this to classify 4 qubit entanglement. And there's a very wonderful theorem, and I wish we'd known about it before, because in many ways it encapsulates the black hole qubit correspondence, which is called the Kostant-Segiguchi theorem. It's a well-known theorem in mathematics. And again, I'll ask you to take my word for it, but the problem of classifying extremal black holes in the STU model mathematically reduces to classifying the real nilpotent orbits of the group SO44 acting on the adjoint representation. And there are 31 ways of doing that. The problem of classifying four qubits, on the other hand, as it turns out, is tantamount to classifying the number of complex nilpotent orbits of SL2 to the fourth acting on the 2222. And the miracle of the constant Sekiguchi theorem is that these two are the same thing. So black holes up here, qubits down here, there's the link. So without doing much work, because most of these orbits were already in the literature, we just filled in a couple of gaps, we were able to classify the four-qubit entanglement. And what we found was that the total number of families without permutations was 9, which agrees with earlier work in the literature. And the new result is that if you don't include permutations, that becomes 31. And it turns out that's a non-trivial, 31 is non-trivially related to 9. Juan León, our chairman, also wrote a paper on this subject using a slightly different approach. And I believe we're compatible with that, but the way we do it is somewhat different, so there's no direct comparison. But this paper was certainly correct, and Juan's paper was correct. But there were lots of other papers, some of which were correct, but they can't all be correct because they're mutually contradictory in some cases. This is what you find if you look in the literature on four qubits. So here's our prediction for four qubits without permutations. There are 31 ways of doing it. So this is our new result. The old result was verified experimentally, but it was already well known. This one, I hope, one could verify experimentally, but I don't think it will be easy. And finally, I'll tell you about the application to the Big Bang. You can't see the picture very well, but here's an equation from our physical review letter on four qubits. And if you look closely, you'll find that it appears on the blackboard over Shelvin's shoulder. Thank you very much.